Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. What's up, Lance?
What's up is that you just caught me very off guard. I was expecting you to ask me how I was, so now I'm totally thrown off. What is up? I don't know. I don't even know. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for asking. And the sky is up. That's the answer.
That's true.
And Lance, in this episode today, we speak with some old friends, a couple of wonderful ladies from the Cults, Crimes, and Cabernet podcast. And they've been through a little bit of a shift in the past year or two because we've had them on before. They were on our old Get Vocal show, and we like to goof off with them. But they were a part of the search party that likely located missing man Brandon Lawson's remains. And that happened earlier in 2022. And they've kind of shifted their show a little bit. And so that's actually what they're here to talk about.
I love seeing it when content creators can grow and recognize that they can actually have a positive impact on the stories that they discuss on their show. And what Whitney and Melissa are doing right now is a really good example.
And you can check out everything that they do at cultscrimesandcabernet.com. And you can also find them on your favorite podcatcher.
And Tim, both Whitney and Melissa recently texted me and asked me if anyone wanted to listen to this episode without the ads, where would they go?
Oh, great question, Whitney and Melissa. Well, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm, or you can just do it right on Apple Podcasts now, right from the app. You can subscribe to Crawl Space Premium. You get every single episode ad-free, and you also get our weekly bonus show. It's a lot of fun. It's well worth it.
Oh, they just texted again, wondering where they can follow us on social media.
Oh, well, that's weird, because I thought they already followed us on social media, and surely they could find us on social media just by searching Crawl Space Podcast or Crawl Space Pod.
Stick around for our wonderful conversation with Whitney and Melissa, but first we have to take a quick break for our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the hosts of the Underworld podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Welcome, Whitney and Melissa, to the podcast. How are you today?
Doing great. Just living the dream. Living the dream.
What weird path are we going to go down before we actually start talking about the topic that is at hand here? I feel like we need to deviate for a little bit, which is on brand for us.
It is. It is. You know, I don't have anything really crazy this time. I mean, we could always go back to Tiger King. That's always a good one.
Oh, do you guys know about the Debbie Collier case?
No.
Okay. Well, I'm going to briefly sum it up, but an update came out. So Debbie Collier is this mother. She went to a Family Dollar, was seen buying a couple of things on surveillance, and then she went missing. What was strange was she sent her daughter a Venmo, her adult daughter, a Venmo for a very specific amount of money. It was, I don't have that, but it's like $2,385.
And that's it. You did it right. You got it perfect.
God. Oh, and stated a very weird cryptic message, like they're never going to let her go, but the key is under this blue plant or something like that. Crazy. Well, then she goes missing and no one knows where she is. And then they end up finding her van, her remains, within a day or two. It's very quick. The circumstances surrounding this is very weird that she did this. She went out to the middle of nowhere. There was no one with her at the Family Dollar, but she was sitting in the parking lot typing out this message to her daughter. So it's very weird. She was by herself. How they found her, there was her stomach was on fire, or she was kind of on fire. She was clutching to a tree. Did not know what was happening with
this. They ruled it a suicide.
And then I believe yesterday it came out, it was a suicide.
Wow. This was released yesterday in the news. The cause of death was suicide?
It was late last night or early this morning that it was released. Melissa texted me at like 8 o'clock this morning and was like, did you see that they ruled it a suicide based on the autopsy results?
And she didn't have all of her clothing on. They found some of the items that she had purchased, like surrounding her. There was like a tarp and a few other things surrounding. And she was kind of in this off of a main road, but down like a valley and a little bit of a wooded area. Her oldest daughter said, oh, she had been giving away some of her stuff in the days prior. It just seems very weird.
Who saw her clutching her stomach and she was on fire?
When authorities found her, she was kind of charred in her mid-range. And she was clutching a tree with her right hand, is what they said, like hanging on to this tree, partially nude as well.
And they only found her because they did LoJack or something on the, she was in a rental car and they tracked the rental car and it was just parked off the side of the road. Then you cross the street and go down this little embankment and there she was behind this big tree stump clutching onto this tree, stomach burned. And then the most random items she bought at the Dollar General store or Family Dollar store, it was like a tarp. There was like five different things. I know a blue tarp was one of them, but a few of those items were found with her. But there's a lot more to this story. Like the daughter and her boyfriend have several domestic violence accusations and reports against each other. The boyfriend supposedly punched Debbie at one point. The daughter was stealing money from the boyfriend. There was drugs involved in their relationship. Debbie, a couple weeks before this, had like a black eye and was all bruised up from the boyfriend beating up Debbie. So there's a whole lots of scenario going on.
The ground was scorched. They said, I was just reading an article, that there were burn marks, but there were no signs of a wood fueled fire had been constructed. So there was no, like, say she was creating a fire because she was cold, let's say, or there wasn't that. Scorch marks on the ground and burn marks on her stomach area.
And the autopsy report said that she died from inhalation of superheated gases, thermal injuries, and hydrocodone intoxication. That's what was listed on the autopsy report.
I always get surprised to hear the lengths that people go to sometimes to commit suicide or cover a crime. I remember when we first heard there was a body found in a body of water chained to a cinder block, we thought, oh my God, this person was murdered. Comes to find out that no, in a lot of cases, people who die by suicide in bodies of water, they chain themselves to a cinder block to prevent themselves from being able to escape.
It was just a very surprising announcement.
And kind of a bummer, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, that wasn't our usual tangent. I'm so sorry.
No, our usual tangent is more lighthearted and fun.
Yes. Yeah. Not so much with that one.
The reason why you reached out to us is to extend this conversation about advocacy and ethics and true crime industry that we operate in. So this might be a good segue into that conversation. When you come across something like this that is breaking news, what's your first reaction as podcasters?
We've always talked about how we don't want to be breaking news. We want to make sure that the family has had a chance to digest the information, how they seem fit. We don't want to be the ones that tell the family because that's not our job. It is not our position. We are not there to comfort them in what will be the hardest day of their lives. We read it, obviously. We consume the information. We take it in. We will share a news article, but we don't want to be the first people to share the news article.
Yeah, we'll typically take our lead from the family. So once they have decided the course of action that they want to take on a particular case, if they want the information out there, they don't want the information out there, that's kind of how we roll.
When did this attitude come about for you guys? For you ladies.
Thank you. Obviously, we didn't start this way. We started like every other true crime content consumer in the world. We wanted to watch all the things. We wanted to listen to all the things. Honestly, for me, not for Melissa, because she doesn't do gruesome, but the more gruesome and gory, the better. I want every single detail. Melissa just wants to hear the story. That's how we started. We started day drinking around a table. We decided to record it because that's what we were doing at the time. Within, I would say, 3 weeks of putting out what we consider now sensationalized content, we thought that we were going about it the wrong way. We started reading family testimonials. We met Jason Watts shortly after we decided to go out in the world and be more hands-on. And from that moment, we knew that we were changing. We weren't going to push the overly covered content. We weren't going to do anything that was just for attention.
I think it makes a big difference once you meet family members of these victims and hear their side of it. I do believe true crime content creators, there is a good place and we can do a lot of good in the world. Definitely meeting families and talking to friends, that's where it all changed, when you realize that these are not faceless victims. They had lives, they had children. It makes such an impact when you humanize them.
Was there a particular family member that brought you to this realization?
I mean, honestly, everything for us started with Jason. Jason Watts, meeting Jason, meeting LaDessa. Brandon's story is going to forever be what secured our role in this industry, in this community, rather. Meeting them, feeling what we felt the first time we were on the side of the road there, we knew then that we had to do something. And just talking about BTK wasn't going to work for us anymore. We had to do much more good.
And then there's been countless others. I mean, Eric from True Consequences, Julie Murray, all of them, like, they just come at it from such a different place. And once you get to know them, you can't go on the record saying all of these horrible things about the victim or their families, or go out there and just laugh about a situation when it's horrible what is happening. So
there's never been a time when the two of you have covered something and made jokes and laughed about it, though.
Yes, there is. I'll be honest. Our episode seven?
Yeah.
I think we've taken it down at this point. It was BTK, and that's why I say it. That's the one that it haunts me to this day. I can't get over the fact that he liked to wear his mom's panties, his wife's panties, whatever. I was obsessed with the panties. And we laughed. I laughed at his expense. It was never at a victim's expense, I will say that. But it was more of a, came from a comedy standpoint. And I'm not proud of it, but it shows the evolution of where we've come from. There was a shift in us from just a content consumer to being an ethical podcaster.
The two of you don't strike me as people who would laugh at the situation, laugh at the survivor of an attack or the family members. And I think it's perfectly healthy. I don't think you should be ashamed for laughing at the idea of that individual wearing or having an obsession with women's underwear. Personally, I find it easier to enter into a conversation about something that's so tragic, like BTK, and just terrifying, if you do sprinkle a little laughter in there, break the ice with like a bit of laughter, and you know what your ultimate, you know, motivations are.
And we didn't take it down because that was the content that we created. We took it down because it sounded like crap. And we've learned now as creators that you can't record in a kitchen with screaming children where it echoes. So our plan was to re-record them and re-release them. But honestly, we've just been so busy. We haven't been able to attend to our back catalog. So many people left us reviews that I couldn't get past the first episode because you can hear kids screaming in the background. And we've obviously evolved. Everyone evolves in this space as far as production quality goes. Like, you just got to stick with it. Start with the current episodes and work your way back to see how far we've come, you know?
Tell those reviewers to hit the bricks. Come on.
In that episode's defense as well, it was more of Whitney not understanding that he stole the women's underwear from the neighbors versus going over there and knocking on the door and asking to borrow the underwear. She was like, what, does he just go over there like a cup of sugar and borrow it? I'm like, no, I'm sure he doesn't ask them for their undergarments. So it was a little bit funny.
In our defense, we recorded that episode at like 9 p.m. and we had been drinking since about 10 a.m. It was just a combination of lots of factors. Day drinking and borrowing panties from a neighbor was very comical to me at that point.
We recorded that actually on my bed. So this is how far we've come. So definitely now, that's what you say, when we've evolved, we've obviously got our quality, audio quality way up, but also we don't drink near as much as we did.
Tim and I are actually on my bed right now, just on different Zoom screens.
Yeah, and we're on mushrooms.
Nice.
And it's a water bed.
Ooh, fun.
It's crazy.
You can hear the ocean in the background.
So tell us about this roundtable discussion that you hosted at the True Crime Podcast Festival in 2022.
Okay, so it was a great event. Whitney and I had done a few other speaking engagements at this conference, but we felt like this particular one we got the most out of. There wasn't as many listeners as we would have liked, but there was a lot of content creators that came to listen to what we had to say about action-oriented advocacy.
So our roundtable discussion, we wanted it to be interactive. That's what roundtable discussions are. But when you talk about action-oriented advocacy, what does that mean? It means doing something to further a case or to be helpful, right? But how do you do that from a room? Just discussing options doesn't do anything. We wanted to give anyone that came into that room several opportunities to advocate before they even left. Most of these were non-monetarily driven, something that people do every single day and just don't realize it, that they could utilize that skill to further a case or to help advocate. When we started with it all, we talked about how many hours a week do people consume true crime content. If you listen to two podcasts, that's at least 2 hours usually of content a week. We all know that anyone that consumes true crime content, that they're probably putting a good 10 hours in. Let's say you watch one documentary, you have three favorite podcasts, and there's a new Netflix series out. Like you're consuming quite a bit of information, if not just reading articles that people share. Sharing a missing persons flyer. How simple is clicking the share button on Facebook? How do you do that ethically and responsibly? You got to make sure that you're sharing accurate information by pulling it from doing a quick Google search and saying, hey, is this an actual missing person or is this another Facebook scam? Because right now there's a big scam going around where a kid's gone missing and they share out this post about 50, 60 times, and then they change that to a owner-financed house.
So just take, there was an Oakland Raiders quarterback. He retweeted an Amber Alert for a missing 3-year-old. He had like 277,000 followers. One of the followers recognized the vehicle in that Amber Alert, called the police. Toddler is recovered without any incident. It's amazing what just a minor share or a retweet, literally not even a second of someone's time, what it can mean for a family that has a missing loved one.
We had an individual on today, a wonderful woman. She's the assistant professor of clinical teaching at the University of Colorado in Denver, Melissa Tackett Gibson. We met her at Obsessed Fest, and she has put together a survey, a pretty extensive survey about why people listen to true crime, what they do with that information, what it makes them feel. Do you feel less safe, more safe? Do you want to protect yourself more? Do you carry now protective items like mace, or did you take a self-defense class? Are you adapting self-protective behavior? And how that's different from like watching a news broadcast or reading something in the paper or any other form of media that's not a podcast. So this conversation is so multifaceted. We're all coming from it from like the content creator point of view. How do you appropriately move on from the topic that you're discussing? So as a creator, how much social media engagement do you put out there after talking about a particular case?
I know we get tagged a lot in social media pages. We don't get to them fast enough a lot of times to where we can retweet it while the person's still missing. So if a day goes by or something like that, oftentimes those people are already found. There's a limit to that too, because if I'm on there all day and retweeting and, you know, Instagram sharing every missing person, like I lose who I am and I can't even do the rest of my job. So I think you need to do it to a point and just be careful to not go too overboard with that unless you're ready to devote several hours a week to those people. Do you suggest creating a new social media account that is focused around that, or do you suggest these people doing it under their personal page?
When we initially had written and came up with these things, it was for our listeners. What can our listeners do that is quick, easy? Because a lot of people want to help, they just don't even know where to start. And we obviously want them to do it ethically. You can't go out and do foot searches on your own, just, you know, knock on a murderer's door. You can't do that. We wanted to give them a few ways that they can just start right now. And a lot of people don't think that sharing a social media post is really that big of a thing. Even on their personal page as a listener, they have families and friends on their, you know, own Facebook page. But it really can, even if you don't have a huge following or anything like that. So that's what we were initially thinking when we came up with this. But now it's completely different for obviously content creators. Because yes, the amount of missing flyers that come through our social medias on the daily, if we tried to share them all, they would get lost in the feed. They wouldn't pay, I think, as close attention to it.
And you also got to factor in algorithms. Facebook algorithms, if you share five posts back to back, they stack them and you're only going to see the one that's on top. You're not going to see every single missing flyer. I think it's a personal choice in the matter. If you want to take hours of your day and devote time to it, then study the Facebook algorithms, start your own private page if that's what you want to choose. If you want your private page to be out there in the public, then do it. Personally, Melissa and I, our personal Facebooks are not public because Melissa's husband was military and he convinced me that mine needs to no longer be public. When I was a real estate agent, all of my information was out there all the time. I've been on both sides of those privacy lines. It's really just personal preference. But what we try to do is, and like you said, Tim, you know, you've got to Google it, check it. One of our tips was if you share something, make sure you update it when that person is found. Don't share another post, go back to your original and edit it and do, you know, edited, updated, found, whatever. So that if that post that you originally shared is still out there and someone else shared it from you, they will see the update and then that news.
I'll go a step further and actually delete the original post, because that person's face has no reason to be out there at that point. What else? What other tips do you have?
The next one we have, this is also goes along with social media, but it's sign a petition. So we know change.org is one of the more common websites. I mean, it has 70-something thousand petitions created every month. It's got 1.7 million people joining every month. We've shared and signed multiple petitions. In my mind, people really don't think that it does much, but getting those signatures gets media in front of it. If the public wants a certain thing happening, this is the first start. Then it also can change legislation as well. So there's kind of multiple things happening there. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, okay, I'll sign it, but they don't think it's going anywhere after that. However, if you and 4,999 friends sign it, things could start moving on whatever cause it is that you're passionate about.
We see the most petitions when it comes to reopening a case, to be honest. That is one of the biggest things with district attorneys and whatnot. When they see that 5,000 people want this case re-examined, especially around election times, that's when people are starting to get movement on closed cases. And that's what we get a lot of.
And you can see why people would not sign thinking that their signature isn't going to go anywhere, because especially change.org, it's a very easy, straightforward process. And it feels like you're not doing the legwork when you sign something on change.org or one of those sites, because it is easy. Feels kind of like, I don't know, did that even go anywhere?
Feels like cheating the system. You're like, there's no way, just me answering two questions, my name being one of them, that it's making a difference. But I do believe, based on a few petitions that we have signed, like things can happen. Not saying they will, but it's a possibility. And sometimes that's all you need is that slight possibility.
The best part about change.org is if you feel that your signature isn't enough, you can take it a step further and donate to the cause or share it on your social media. Again, social media runs the world. So if you share that petition to your friends, maybe 500 of them, if you have that many friends, didn't even know that this was an issue, and now they do. You might get an extra 10 signatures that way. You never know.
Yeah, I think physical letters are a good idea too, if organized in a certain way for a specific campaign. I think that can be more powerful than email. Definitely more powerful than emails, but even potentially a petition, depending on how that's organized.
We've also taken part in phone campaigns to legislation, just like the Leon Laurel's case. If you don't know about that, on the 15th, I called and bugged the DA saying, hey, you need to check this out. And it was a 5-minute phone call.
Someone hears you say, I called the DA. Instantly, a lot of people are like, I don't think I'm ever going to pick up the phone and call the district attorney. That's very intimidating.
I think that this is a good explanation of me versus Melissa. She's a introvert and I'm an extrovert. So she would rather text a DA than call a DA, just because phone calls are scary. I get it, but I'll talk to a rock.
I was like, I'd like to say I'm a millennial and we don't believe in phone calls, but also I'm an introvert and I'm just like, why do people call ever? I am not that type of person to call.
To quell any nerves, 9 times out of 10, you're getting a secretary. She's writing down your name and that you called about X thing. You don't actually talk to the DA.
Wait, the DA doesn't pick up and be like, Mr. DA here.
Surprise. No.
What do you want?
No. And honestly, it's just... You don't know who you're talking to unless you know them personally. Like, it's just another person.
Did you like my DA impersonation?
That was pretty good, Lance. Yeah, I was impressed.
I took all the DAs that I've ever heard and I put them into one impersonation.
It was strong.
He's got a brick for a phone if you are watching the YouTube version.
Is it the Nokia brick?
No, it's just, it's like a brick that you use to build a house.
Oh, okay.
It's heavy, yeah.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
The next idea that we had was something that's slightly monetary, but not really, because you're already paying for it anyways. Amazon Smile. Very set it and forget it. You're already buying stuff on Amazon, which most people are. So a portion of eligible products will go directly to that nonprofit.
I have had mine set to PI for the Missing for the last year, and I'm pretty sure they've gotten a couple $100 just out of me, because I'm fairly confident I alone keep Jeff Bezos's yacht afloat.
Yeah, that's a great call. But yeah, Amazon Smile, very easy to set up and choose a nonprofit. And there's a percentage that is automatically donated. Like you said, set it and forget it.
And thank you for setting yours to Private Investigations for the Missing.
Yeah, we really appreciate that.
And a lot of companies that people work for will also do donation matches. I used to work for eBay and they were really good about, hey, pick a nonprofit and we'll donate our money there. And so it was nice. So there are ways without actually money coming out of your pocket, because we do know times are hard right now. Groceries are ridiculous. So a lot of people don't have that extra money to put towards things that they're passionate about or different organizations, but they want to help in another way.
And we both have boys. So paying for groceries right now is hard because they eat a lot. Another easy way, because so many of us millennials and Gen Zers got into the 23andMe Ancestry.com DNA testing kit. If you're looking for a good Christmas present, a lot of those companies do Christmas sales, and that's like a really good gift to give somebody in your family if you ever wanted to try that. They all allow you to download your DNA data file that you can then turn around and upload into GEDmatch. It took you 30 seconds maybe to do the whole process, Melissa?
Yeah, once I read the instructions, it was a lot easier. Download it, upload it to that site. It does take a couple of days before they've done their smart people thing and lined it up with other DNA tests that are in the system. But this could potentially, and has, found the identity of Jane Doe's and John Doe's. Now it can also help get certain criminals off the streets if they're violent. Just know that that's also a risk that you take by putting in your DNA. It's very straightforward on the site where it says, do you want your DNA to only be research-based, which means they're not going to give it to law enforcement? You can click on that. I don't know how secure that is or what really makes a difference. Whitney and I talk about all the time that these murderers, these kidnappers, these rapists are not going to be able to do this for long and get away with it with the advances in DNA technology and everyone or a lot of people putting their DNA to be analyzed and compared to other ones. It's going to make committing these type of crimes very difficult.
There has to be something that can be addressed when people are nervous or they express anxiety in giving their DNA, thinking that something's going to happen. Like, I'm not a criminal. I'm not giving my DNA because they're going to mistake my DNA for a criminal's DNA. I mean, that's a legit concern. I've heard people say that.
I think it's a learning thing. Obviously, this is a newer technology. It's not foolproof yet. I think it's headed in the right direction. We have talked at length with the wonderful people over at DNA Doe Match. And I mean, when we were at CrimeCon with you guys, they matched 11 people in the crowd to potential does out there. That's amazing.
Wow.
That now we'll have a name, that have a face and a name, finally. And then you look at the big cases like the Golden State Killer. He walked free for how many years? And because his second nephew, twice removed or whatever, decided to do a 23andMe kit, he was finally apprehended. I just think that people need to take a deep breath and realize that this is something that is doing more good than bad. I understand the anxiety of it. Personally, I have not done it yet. I plan to do it. I've been asked not to do it by some family members, but I'm going to do it anyway. You know, it's just, they shouldn't have committed the crimes.
Are you waiting to get some crimes expunged from your record before you do it?
Not me, but someone in my family tree, maybe.
Also, upload your profile to DNA Solves. That is the database at Othram Labs that they are trying to build to be as big as GEDmatch or CODIS. You know, obviously, it's going to take a lot of work. But yeah, if you were to get your DNA profile, you can send it to them and they can include it there too. And that's for law enforcement use.
I was really nervous submitting it. I had done these DNA tests a year or two ago, but just when Whitney and I were finally talking about doing this whole action-oriented advocacy and the fact that I hadn't uploaded to GEDmatch, I was like, well, I'm kind of being slightly hypocritical, but I was nervous as well. And you never know how things will work out, but I'm like, okay, well, most likely it'll be fine. It'll be fine. That's our saying of life. It'll be fine.
Curious what you think about the idea of really engaging your listeners in the sponsors that support your show. Because without the sponsors providing the promo codes that will then track the people who are using them to your show and the sponsors come back again, that is how this whole thing keeps working. And that's how you're able to do the show, put the story out there, do the next story. If you don't have the support of the listeners engaging with the sponsors using the promo codes and you're supporting the cause.
Yeah, I think early on when we started our podcast, we struggled with monetizing it, period. We considered it a hobby. We felt icky taking money, but then we started looking at how much good we're doing and how many people we are reaching. And if we had more money to help further these cases, I mean, we've sent flyers to people. I've printed and shipped flyers more times than I care to count. I have donated water to more foot searches than I can probably count on two hands. We've also donated our time, which is our next volunteer effort for action-oriented advocacy. Money isn't just to line our pockets. It promotes so many more things within this industry. It gets us out further. It furthers the cases. You get to a bigger audience, and you have to have that ad support to be able to do this. It's a very time-consuming job.
Yeah, Lance, that wasn't even on our list, but that is a very big one that all of our listeners can do. Listen to those ads. You really don't know what you're missing until you listen to them. And then you're like, hey, I need that in my life.
We work really hard on our ad copy. Do you know what? We wrote for Manscaped, we wrote an ad and it took us probably, I don't know, 4 days before we could decide what to even say about that.
Because it's not your typical ad. No. Either. They wanted it to be as, what did they say? Risque as possible. Yes.
And we're not risque.
If we're not.
We struggled talking about underwear for an underwear company.
It was fun at the end of the day with that ad.
Yeah.
I mean, we have fun with our ads too. We try to keep a common theme of...
How contrived can we make this sound?
Tim, if I'm ever looking for a service that provides me with humane, farm-raised, free-range chicken breasts... Oh, I'm glad you asked.
Yeah, I love it. Love it. We try to keep ours really fun too, but yeah. Manscaped was definitely the one that was the most difficult for us, especially because we weren't using the products. We gave them to our husbands, but they said we were not allowed to talk about any of their use of the products. So it was just downhill from there.
Tim and I did an ad for Third Love.
Oh, yes. I've heard that on a couple podcasts, and it always sounds so weird.
I think that might be the most awkward ad that we've done.
I guess bras are better than the Weed Whacker 4000.
The Lawnmower 4.0.
The Lawnmower 4.0 is one of Manscaped's products.
And what was the ball toner?
Okay.
And it's exactly what you think it is.
What is that?
Some spray for male genitalia.
Like for color?
No. Firmness? I don't know.
For advocacy.
One ad at a time.
There's our tangent. You wanted a weird tangent? There's your Weed Whacker tangent.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
So time, that's something that not many people have, but it's something that we had when we started this. Melissa and I are hands-on people. We've always volunteered at like our kids' schools, anywhere we can. Time was an easy one for us to give early on, but we want to make sure that you're responsible with this. Again, like Melissa said earlier, don't go perform a foot search on your own because, one, you could get lost yourself. Two, you need to make sure you have a whole team with you. It just, safety first, guys, safety first. There's easy things to do, like look on local volunteer groups. Facebook groups are a good thing. They talk about needing volunteers for foot searches all the time. Maybe it's just a candlelight vigil where you can go and stand and be supportive of the family. There's plenty of ways to donate your time. Another person had actually talked to us about this. I believe it was Courtney from Nefarious Nightmare had talked about volunteering to help less tech savvy people. And that's offering to run their Facebook page for them. Maybe they don't have a Facebook or they don't even know about it or they don't want to live this trauma every day. I would have never thought to donate my social media time.
But even like graphics or flyers, which we've done before as well, few minutes on the computer and it can make a big difference to a family that shouldn't have to be doing all of that alone while they are trying to find their missing loved one.
Do you have any suggestions on how someone would approach the family member, break the ice and say, you have no social media presence, I'm good with this. Do you want me to be your spokesperson?
I'm a bit 50-50 on this. I do believe that it is okay to reach out to family members, like once, send them a message, email, that kind of thing. Now, if they don't respond, don't obviously keep hassling them because they've got enough to deal with. A lot of the family members have stated, oh, when they covered my son's case, they never reached out. I wish they would have reached out and let me know they were covering it. So I know most family members or some family members are okay with that. We have, and we reach out to family members when we're doing our Merlot files, our deep dives. It's always very scary. You have to come at a very delicate place, be very careful with your words, but let them know your heart's in the right place and that you just want to help if there's anything that they need taken off their plate, that you're willing to help and kind of just leave the ball in their court is what I would say. They might be going through a lot. They probably have their own issues besides, you know, their own personal issues besides their family member. So it could be a lot. So we've had both. We've had family members completely agree, full transparency, open, and then we've had some not respond. We've really not had any that are like upset at us, because then I would probably cry.
Well, we had one guy, I believe it was in Iowa or Ohio, that section of the US. His daughter reached out to us and mentioned, what does my dad's case have to do with anything you're doing? And when we explained, hey, we are here, we are trying to help you, we are trying to further your dad's case or create some waves in his investigation, they were much more receptive. And even months later, messaged us and said, hey, this is going on. My cousin that lived in the house is now, it's now being repoed, even though he's making the payments because it's not in his name. There was a whole shenanigans with that. How, is there any way we can help? People are mostly receptive if you come at it with grace from the right perspective. Don't come in like you're some big dog and just wanting to squash them. They're already hurting enough. Just try to be helpful.
I wouldn't even initially expect a response because a lot of times the cases that we're talking about are unsolved. And so the secondary victims of those cases are naturally less trusting of people than when they were, when their loved one was still around.
They have been scorned once before because their case is still unsolved. And they might see it as it's just sitting in a box collecting dust. Even if law enforcement is working on it, it's hard for them. And it's hard for someone to just come in from nowhere. Who's this chick from Texas asking about my loved one? That's scary too.
But like Whitney said, there's a lot of local groups that you can volunteer for. I mean, just in my local area, there's 3 or 4 different human trafficking coalitions that are always looking for volunteers. We have our sheriff's department, which I almost thought, but my husband said no, to be a citizen deputy, go around patrolling the neighborhoods. There's so many opportunities for volunteer work, even crossing guards for local schools. There's things that you can do to help create a more safe area, like neighborhoods and stuff.
I love that you said that because the hands-on, the community building element to it is hugely important because it just obviously puts you face to face with somebody else and you have a real conversation. And that, I think, speaks a little bit more to the, I guess, overall message, as opposed to two-dimensional or one-dimensional Zoom chats and things like that. You know, just getting out there is very important.
One of the biggest things that came up from our roundtable discussion, those were all of the non-monetary ways that you could advocate. that we presented in our roundtable. And the conversation that came up from that, actually from Dr. Scott from LA Not So Confidential, who sat in on our roundtable, was that he's realized from his role in this community that family members don't know where to start to ask for help. And that's the biggest issue, because they're overwhelmed with their loved one being a victim. They're overwhelmed with dealing with law enforcement to make sure that the case is being furthered. They're overwhelmed with the public and the media bashing their doors down for a story. Where do they start to help find the right avenues and the right people to help them, as opposed to just looking for a story?
So at the end of the day, there's no manual on what to do, like after you obviously call law enforcement, call 911 if someone's missing or murdered. But like Ledessa had said, she said she was a 25-year-old mother of four kids, and she did not have a clue what to do or anything like that. And then you have these cases where the significant other is the person of interest, which everything is being scrutinized about what they do. Are they doing the right thing because of the public? Are they doing this because this is what they feel they should do? It's just, it's such a roller coaster of emotions where no one knows what to do. So yes, Dr. Scott was talking about, you almost need like a to-do list. Check these things off. Make sure you're, you know, contacting these people, because that could make a difference in finding someone quickly or not.
You both thought you were getting into this for the fame and fortune.
Yep.
Yep. Oh, yes. I was getting into it for the wine, but an excuse.
Well, tell us about the wine. Tell us about the wine.
What? I don't have any wine right now.
Over the last 3 years, we've gone through so many wine, so much wine. I have two just ready on my desk at all times.
Nice.
I'm pulling up the website now.
I've got a red and a white, so whatever mood
you're
in,
we're
ready. Oh,
I'm not looking at my Zoom. Did you just hold it up?
I did.
Oh, hold it up again. Keep it there. Keep it there. Keep it. Hold it. Bam. I did not just take a screenshot.
That's fine.
Didn't think you were going to. We just have the last one that is monetary. There are a ton of organizations out there that are always looking for donations.
Just unfortunately, it always comes down to money. Every organization always needs more money to be able to test more DNA, to be able to do more research. Everyone always needs more funds. There's not enough funds to operate.
I mean, we've got the Innocence Project, the National Center for Victims of Crimes, and literally there's probably thousands out there that are doing amazing work that could use extra money if you have extra money, and it's the end of the year. So if you need a good tax deduction, send it off.
That's right.
Give us your money.
The DA came
DA
back.
Again. The DA says so.
And that's really our spill. We just wanted to share that it's easier than some people think to get involved if you have the guts to, I guess.
Right mindset?
Right mindset. That's what I was looking for.
Is that what you'd wrap it up in like one sentence or like your elevator pitch?
Do you have guts?
I think it's just that people don't know where to start. And it doesn't have, you don't have to look seven steps down the road. It's as easy as a Facebook share. Just go at it with the right intentions. And that's it. I don't know why I said and.
And?
That's the end of it. Yeah, they could be more than true crime content consumers. They could be advocates.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great. I think this is great that you're raising awareness for this cause, and we really appreciate it. Thank you so much for telling us about these tips and steps to go through if you're trying to ramp up your advocacy game. Is there anything else you'd like to say on the show here today?
Well, I have a question for y'all. Is there any that we didn't cover that you would suggest outside of what we've already discussed?
Well, several of them jogged some thoughts, so I gave them to you in real time. I will think about it, and if anything comes to mind, definitely let you know.
I was just going to say, I think what you're doing by speaking with other content creators, asking to go on their shows and asking them to go on your show is also very important, because then you can get those ones that you didn't think that were relevant for whatever reason, or you just didn't think of it, like the sponsors, like something like that. The worst that'll happen is that you're being redundant, right?
And we've always, you know, we've always said, not always, but since we shifted our mindset and evolved, we are very much ethics over entertainment. We are here to promote good and further cases and do good in this community. And we know that there's a giant shift coming in the true crime community. The conversations are already being had. I mean, when Dahmer came out on Netflix, immediately it was Dahmer's up here, everybody's watching it. And the next article below it is, should we be watching it or should we be second guessing this? And I think that that's huge, because 3 years ago when Melissa and I started it, that wasn't even on the table to discuss.
But thank you both for having us on. We always love chatting with you guys.
Yes, thank you. This was
great. No better way to wrap up the week.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. By honoring your career calling, you impact your family, your friends, and your community. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.